Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I am your host, Todd Embley. And today I sit down with an old friend, Kevin Hsu, founder of the bilingual newsletter Interconnected, which offers sharp analysis on the intersection of technology, investing, and geopolitics between the United States and China. Kevin has become one of the most thoughtful and trusted voices interpreting Chinese tech trends around the world. Together, we explore the evolving AI landscape in China, examining how players like DeepSeek and Alibaba are changing the race, how export controls are impacting development, and why Kevin believes 2025 could be the year of the AI riff. We also unpack China's open source culture, cloud strategy, and what Western analysts continue to get wrong about China's innovation ecosystem. If you want to better understand the complex forces shaping tech and policy between the world's two largest economies, this episode is a must listen. Enjoy.
I think one company that people should pay more attention to is Xiaomi and also the Xiaomi ecosystem. So Xiaomi used to be this low-end smartphone maker and is now one really leveling up to become a premium brand smartphone provider. It is also making its own electric vehicles that all happened within the last 3-4 years, really, that is now really giving Tesla a run for its money. And very recently, it started to release its own chip, its own flagship smartphone chip, kind of like the A14 in your iPhone. They are starting to really show results on that front that was 10 years in the making, but they're finally getting to be able to ship some products in their own indigenous chip making.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Kevin, welcome back to The Negotiation.
Thank you so much for having me back, Todd. It's been a minute.
It's been a few years. I mean, we stay in touch, but it's been a few years since you've been on the show. Where in the world are you these days?
I am now based in Tennessee, the volunteer state here in the United States, the Midwest of the United States.
I'm Canadian. Why do they call it the volunteer state?
I believe, and somebody's going to throw, you know, virtual eggs at me for getting this wrong, because I just moved here, so cut me some slack. But I believe there was a lot of volunteers who joined the First World War or the Second World War.
Yeah.
Tennesseans who were very patriotic or, you know, passionate about defending freedom abroad, et cetera, et cetera. And that earned the state, the volunteer state as a moniker. But again, could be completely wrong. Someone ChatGPT me to fact check this.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds right. I'll buy it for now. Okay. That's good.
Sounds good.
Well done. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. For the audience who didn't listen to the first episode that you're on, just tell us a little bit about your background and your experiences, and then what led you to launch Interconnected, what Interconnected is all about.
Sure. So Interconnected as a newsletter, I started writing about 5+ years ago. Prior to that, I was working in the technology field in Silicon Valley for companies like GitHub, which is the Microsoft-owned developer platform and open source code repository platform. And before that, worked for a couple of startups in the open source kind of cloud computing world. And prior to tech, I did a degree at Stanford studying law. And prior to that, I worked in DC I was a part of the first Obama campaign team and then joined the administration after the 2008 victory, served in the Commerce Department and also the White House doing mostly press and communications work. And if you kind of connect the dots backwards, like Steve Jobs likes to say, that all kind of culminated in a very natural way to the kind of things I like to write about in my newsletter, which is connecting the dots and finding the Venn diagram space between technology, geopolitics, and business, which is now becoming completely interconnected in all sorts of ways that used to be able to separate fairly well. And then more recently, I launched my own investment firm called Interconnected Capital, which is a classic long-only hedge fund that invests in the picks and shovels of AI globally. So U.S. companies, Indian companies, whatever company that actually is fueling this AI wave across the globe, that is my kind of specialty.
I want to start by almost looking at a Venn diagram in of itself between perception and the gaps in perception of the U.S. about China, China about the U.S. Can you highlight maybe what our Western audiences or the Western society most misunderstand about China's tech ecosystem?
So I think the biggest gap in understanding of your general Western audience about the Chinese tech ecosystem is that it is a very fascinating hybrid of state-led capitalism, fueled by kind of cutthroat free market competition on the bottom. Most people gravitate towards the state-led part of the conversation, which is very natural. Most people don't know enough about China to know the nuances, but enough to say this is a one-party state, it's authoritarian, it's led by this one guy, et cetera, et cetera. So everything kind of falls naturally in the state-led side of the ledger, which does exist. What is completely missing and almost hard for people to square the round peg, because how could these two things exist simultaneously? But it exists in a very ferocious fashion, which is, aside from the state-led part, there is incredible competition on between companies, between products, between services. You know, Todd, you spend your good part of your career in China during the internet boom, and the competition among internet companies at the time and still is very, very ferocious. And now we are moving into other kinds of products, like electric vehicles, for example, like smartphones and more hardware product. That's all happening within the Chinese ecosystem. And what ends up happening is that that free market element of the dynamic has kind of pushed the birth of a lot of incredibly competitive companies on a global stage that people are just starting to recognize the name of. BYD, right? Xiaomi. Now we have DeepSeek in the AI world. DeepSeek wasn't a state-led program. It was a hedge fund. I wouldn't call it a side project, but it was born out of a hedge fund that devoted a lot of resources to now building AI models that was very much happening and competing with other, like, tens of hundreds of AI model companies in China at the time, 2 years ago. And it just birthed out of that onto the scene. But then, you know, people kind of come back to the state-led story. So that is, in my mind, the biggest kind of high-level misconception is this very uncomfortable coexistence between state-led and free market competition that somehow is existing in tandem in China.
Yeah, I think that's a very good assessment. And speaking of assessments, your current assessment of China's overall the progress in AI, and if you could relate that to the progress in the U.S. and maybe just talk about do a comparison there on the AI side, and then where are Chinese firms maybe ahead, and then maybe where are they behind?
So the way I like to think about this question is you separate generative AI from classic machine learning AI. So pre-ChatGPT versus post-ChatGPT, because AI has been around in both economies, the US and China, for, you know, well over like two decades up until the ChatGPT moment, right? So if you look at AI models as a part of AI, these are, you know, GPT models, Anthropic models, Google's model, Alibaba's models, DeepSeek is a model, right? All it has produced is a model so far. That one is neck to neck, I'd say, but with the US side still having a, let's say, 3 to 6 month lead in terms of benchmarks. If we look at the hardware side, these are GPUs, these are processors, these are things that NVIDIA and AMD is making to put into data centers to fuel the training and the inferencing of these AI models. The U.S. is much more ahead. Part of that has to do with U.S. export control that has also been in place in the last few years to deliberately slow down China's own capability in terms of semiconductor advancement. So there is a larger gap there, I say, on the infrastructure, GPU processor side of the conversation. Now, looking ahead to automation in general, though, not just AI models, generative AI, but automation in general. Like, where are there more robotics being put into the real world to, say, make manufacturing more efficient, cheaper, or to make even, you know, autonomous driving more proliferating in everyday society? China is actually ahead in a lot of those vectors already in terms of the number of robotics that are in factories. China has deployed more of those than almost any country combined in the last 3 years. And if you look at that as a vector of AI, there's a part of it that China has been racing ahead for a while versus not just the United States, but almost every other country.
Okay. I want to pull out something that you wrote. It was a piece titled, is 2025 the year of the AIRIF? You even call the AIRIF, and that's AI-driven reductions in force, the best, if not only, form of walking the walk to show what AI can really do. Unpack that for me. It's a little on the cryptic side to me. What do you mean by that? Why 2025? And what are we seeing in the tech industry that makes that idea so important?
Sure. So reduction in force, right, or RIF or IIF is this tech term that basically means laying off a lot of people and reducing those positions in the process.
Workforce.
Right. Workforce, right? Reduction in force, right? And what I meant by this rather cryptic title, the AI RIF is coming this year, is that I'm seeing a lot of leading technology companies CEOs, like Shopify, for example, out of Canada, Duolingo, Box, starting to really sing the clarion that in the future, they're going to build their company where they have to adopt AI first before permitting headcount growth, right? AI first, headcount second. What they're telling all their team is that you better, if you're going to ask for a headcount budget, make sure you do everything you can do with AI first. And if you still cannot accomplish those things, then we will green light you to hire more people, right? That's kind of sign number one for me. That just happened in the last month or so. And then you had Microsoft and CrowdStrike, and I believe more companies proactively laying off people, so doing their own RIF. And part of that justification is actually because of AI. They're now laying off software engineers, product managers, more technical people, not just non-technical people that used to always be the victim of these RIFs traditionally. And what I'm seeing happening is that this is really the only way a lot of these companies, Microsoft, Google in particular, they're all pushing and building AI products to sell to large enterprises, right? And the best value proposition that is still in the market now is that it's a productivity gain. It helps your workforce do 30% more of this, 40% more of that, and you can do more with less. But it's a very hypocritical sales pitch, if you will, if while you're pushing these products onto your customers, your own headcount is bloating, right? Because the best way to really sell this stuff is to dog food it yourself and actually realize the gain first. And the way you really show the gain is not some survey that says, oh, internally, we have 40% gain now because we use these coding agents, is to actually probably eliminate some coders, and some engineers. It's a bit of a dark reality, but I think this is where we're going with this particular post that I'm writing, and will continue to kind of stay on this theme, because that is the best sales pitch for all these AI services to really be adopted, is you have to kind of walk the walk by reducing your own workforce because of the gain you got from AI first.
I want to move on to talk a little bit about DeepSeek and bring that up. It feels potentially for you and I, who have these media arms to our lives, DeepSeek might seem like a little bit of old news. But I think for a lot of people and a lot of listeners, they're still just becoming aware of DeepSeek, and especially from the event that happened, certainly the news around the specific event that made them just kind of go viral. Let's talk about DeepSeek. What makes DeepSeek so significant?
So the DeepSeek moment was probably exactly 4 months ago. It definitely felt like 4 years ago for me. What makes DeepSeek significant, and I'll also talk about the part that maybe is a little bit overblown. What's significant is that a small team in China was able to produce a very well-performing set of AI models with like a tiny fraction of the cost. And there's still debate about how small the cost is, et cetera, but I don't think anyone can dispute the fact that the cost input relative to the model performance just blew everything out of the water at the time, right? And what is also interesting about DeepSeek is that it is completely open sourced. It is the most open source friendly AI model still to date. It is licensed under what this thing called the MIT license. And for those of folks who want to dig into the nuances of open source licensing, it is the most permissive form of licensing, meaning that you can do anything you want, literally anything you want, with this set of powerful AI models coming out of DeepSeek. And they're not going to charge you. They don't care what you do. It's kind of the freest form of open source, which contrasts very heavily to one Meta's Llama model, which is at the time the most well-known set of open source models that came out of Meta. But Meta has always used its own licenses to restrict some usage. They will probably charge you if your usage goes up to, I believe, 700 million monthly active users, something like that. So there's restrictions to that. It's a commercial license. It's not like a free open source license. So the fact that a tiny Chinese lab came out of a really good model and decided to give the entire world for free, all these things added up together, made it a moment that, again, challenged a lot of people's assumption about what is AI, right? People assume AI will be super costly, yet this little shot made it super cheap to be able to do and still perform well. It came out of China, out of nowhere, and it also gave it to the world. It's way more open than OpenAI itself when it comes to the openness of their AI innovation. All this added up to a lot of, I think, cognitive dissonance, if you will, that it led to becoming a moment that I think people are still trying to wrap their head around. And I think DeepSeek any day now will be releasing their next version of their reasoning model. So the whole AI community is like holding their breath, waiting for it to come out and, do the dissection just like we did, 4 months ago.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of that breath holding is probably happening in the US, waiting to see what happens there. Now, you have framed DeepSeek as open versus closed, not just in brackets, about the US versus China. Can you explain what you mean by that? How should we think about the role of open source models versus proprietary approaches in the global AI race?
So the thing with open versus closed that I think is much more impactful of a framing when you think about DeepSeek is that open source technology has been one of the largest democratizing drivers of technology adoption overall, right? This has been happening for 30 plus years. Linux is the OG of open source operating software that has really eroded, at the time, the monopoly of Windows. And now even Microsoft's own cloud computing platform, Azure, runs more Linux boxes than Windows at this point. And the reason why that's significant is because people, generally speaking, like to use things that they can customize, that they can learn from. Of course, the free part helps a lot, but there's a lot more than that. And AI up to the DeepSeek moment has been much more on the closed side of things, where the big labs like OpenAI and Anthropic, they're putting out really good products, obviously very useful, but the secret sauce is a very close hold. And there's a natural rhythm to the closed versus open kind of evolution in all of technology. Linux versus Windows was one. Netscape versus Internet Explorer was another one, right? Oracle versus hundreds of open source database is still one that is continuing right now. Android versus iOS is another one. And DeepSeek versus, say, OpenAI, or open models versus closed models, is yet another, I think, very predictable rhythm of technology evolution that we've seen this movie before. And this is really the most important movie that we should be watching to see how does AI proliferate across the entire world versus a much more, in my opinion, myopic framing that this is like a US versus China thing. Like, it is to a certain extent, but it's by no means the most interesting or the most kind of long-term impactful way of looking at this moment.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny. It always got me thinking. My son likes to build models, you know, cars, trains, things like this, but he still prefers to get Lego sets.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why always Lego sets? He's like, well, you know, I can build the thing, but then when I'm done, I can build just about anything else I want to as well. And I'm like, oh, so Lego is open source.
That's right. So kind of Lego is the classic open source model of children learning how to build physical stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned your son as the prototypical example in your life, because one of the biggest thing about open sourcing technology is actually the educational multiplier effect of it. You cannot learn how to program with a closed source operating system. But if you get a copy of Linux, you get a bunch of people together in a classroom, you start to hack it, you start to play with it, you start to look at the code. That is the best way to learn how to replicate something that is currently existing, but then to build something new and better that you cannot even imagine it yet. And you just cannot, there's no educational value to proprietary software, even though they might be very nice to have and easy to use right off the shelf.
Yeah, that's why I think I always preferred chemistry to biology. There's no changing what biology told me it had to be. Okay, let's talk about tech giants in China. Let's talk about Alibaba. Talk to me a little bit about how they're doing in terms of their cloud, their Aliyun, and their AI. And are there any other major players that catch your eye that we want to talk about?
So Alibaba, as a cloud player and also an AI lab, has been gaining steam quite a bit after the DeepSeek moment as well. Now, credit to where credit is due, Alibaba's set of AI models, Qianwen or Qwen, as is known in the Western lexicon, is actually also an open source set of models that are very permissively licensed prior to DeepSeek. Somehow it just never got the virality that DeepSeek got. Maybe Qianwen is just a really bad, you know, marketing word, or maybe, you know, for whatever reason, Alibaba has actually been really plowing forward without the kind of recognition that it probably deserves. But now Qianwen as a series of models, so it's not just one model, it comes in like 10, 12 different sizes at this point, coming out of the Alibaba AI lab shop, is really becoming another primary source actually for developers everywhere, not just in the United States or China, but in Europe and elsewhere, to start tinkering and using it as a baseline to build products, to learn about AI models, to fine-tune their own AI models. Again, there's no restriction to these models. If you want to just like tweak it a little bit so it does something a little bit better, and you call it something else, it's all good, right? So Alibaba is very much at the forefront of this open model wave as well. And that makes business sense, because all it really cares about is that ultimately you use AliCloud, which is this massive cloud infrastructure that is still like third or fifth largest in the entire world. You know, it doesn't get mentioned as often, but it has data centers almost everywhere around the world, including the United States still, and is investing very heavily in Southeast Asia and, you know, the Middle East, all the places where you would expect a Chinese company can still do well globally these days, as well as China itself. And it's definitely a juggernaut. I don't want to say it's like killing it right now. It has its own issues because of all the messy reorg that vexed Alibaba as an entire company over the last 2 years. I think they're still coming out of that and still focusing themselves to really grow now. So we're just hitting that inflection point for AliCloud. But it's one of the ones that are, you know, definitely to watch from an AI perspective.
Now, much of our audience is probably very familiar with Alibaba for their e-commerce side of their business, which is where, you know, AliExpress and whatnot. This is where a lot of people kind of were their first intros into what Alibaba, the company, is. How do you assess the company after its recent reorganization?
I think it's a lot more focused now. I think the consistent messaging of AI-led growth through all of its business verticals, right? Like the e-commerce is still the cash cow of the company, but clearly it's cloud business for it to grow globally. AI is the big driver of that. And of course, the AliCloud infrastructure supports its own e-commerce platform, supports AliExpress, supports Ele.me in China, the food delivery thing, right? Supports global logistics. So it is both internally supporting its own other business divisions, also being sold to third-party companies as their cloud platform. And it's just a much more focused company. It's still a really large company. So the speed of focusing can only be so quick when you have that many people. But I think after, I would say, 2 years of corporate reorg in the wilderness, the company, at least internally, is starting to be more focused. Now, what does that mean in the broader context? I think it's still a big question. It still lives within the reality of the Chinese economy. The economy has to grow for Alibaba to grow. And not vice versa, right? I think the AI in general still needs to be more adopted and accepted, especially open source AI. That will be a vector of growth, hopefully, for Alibaba Cloud globally. But that takes a long time to really proliferate. But Alibaba has a lot of cash. It's a very stable financial company. So it will be around for a long time. When does the growth really inflect? So you get back to like the halcyon days of, I don't know, 2016. It may never happen again, but it's certainly a technology company that will always be around and I think doing very interesting things.
Ele.me is one of the top three names of companies that I think I've ever come across. You want to tell everybody what Ele.me translates to?
Well, Ele.me translates to, are you hungry?
Yeah.
In Chinese. Yeah,
the way
that exists on your phone, then you kind of know what to do with it.
I even parse it down further. I just go, hungry?
Sure. Right. It could be anybody. It doesn't have to be you who's hungry. It could be somebody else who's hungry.
Food delivery service company, just hungry?
Yeah.
You know, like, why, yes, I am.
Right.
How handy you are here. Okay, back to China, U.S. tech relations. Okay, this is a little bit of a long one. There's two questions in here. So given recent policies, like, and it has been so apropos, we're talking about this today because of the last few days, tariffs, export controls on semiconductors and AI chips, and now rare earth metals, which I think China still produces like 70-80% of the world's rare earth metals, which are a big, big deal when it comes to chips and technology, other industrial policies. How do you see the current state of tech decoupling or competition? Are these restrictions actually going to slow down China's tech progress, or could they have second order effects? For example, you've written about how strict chip bans might close the last exit for China's AI firms. Go.
That's a pretty big question, for sure.
It's huge.
I'm gonna time post these discussions as I like to do now with podcasts, because depending on when you release this episode, the world could completely change because of the tweet.
Oh my gosh!
Right?
Yes.
So we are on like what, mid morning, May 29th, 2025. And you're correct. There is a lot on the table, as far as increasing restrictions from both China and the U.S. now. I think prior to maybe Trump's liberation tariff escalation that just sort of de-escalated recently, it's been more of a one-sided restriction from the U.S. perspective, at least from my point of view. You know, export control becomes increasingly more stringent when it comes to AI semiconductors, not just the products themselves, like GPUs and memory chips, but also the equipment that make advanced semiconductors, which if you look at it from the United States perspective, is actually a very rational thing to do if your framework for the future is this almost deathmatch type competition with China. And if you have all the goods, you just don't want to sell them the goods to empower them to get ahead in this competition. Now, I think some of the people who are very much a proponent of this approach were a little surprised by how quickly or how much China can still indigenize these technology. I think some people thought this would be at least give China, give the U.S. a 5, even 8, 10-year advantage. But it turns out it's going to be a lot less than that as China continues to basically replicate and advance a lot of these things that are kind of off limit, right, to acquire, at least acquire legal from the Chinese side. But now you have all this other stuff thrown in there, like jet engine is on the table now, rare earth obviously is on the table, right? And it's very confusing. I think a decoupling has always been kind of in motion, like a slow boiling frog in a lot of ways in the last 5 years. I'm actually strangely optimistic, quite frankly, about all of this stuff being on the table. I do think, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and hold me to it, is I do think there will be some kind of a deal and a grand bargain between the United States and China that takes all of this stuff off the table. Now, I believe gaining market share from the Trump administration's perspective, or market access to China for the purpose of reducing trade deficit with China, is a very sought after outcome. And if you look at what are the things that China really wants to buy or needs to buy from the United States, it is a lot of these high-end equipment, technology products. We certainly don't make the toys, you know, enough to sell it to the other side. We don't even make the cars that are really attractive right now to sell it to the other side, but we know we can try. And some farming products, and that's about it. Right. So I think a lot of this stuff feels very kind of tense, and maybe we are bottoming out on the relationship. But I do think all this stuff being discussed now openly on the table, so you could possibly be taking them off the table, is a plausible but less entertained scenario in terms of an ultimate outcome.
I have a burning question after you've said all of that, but like, given everything that China has as far as technology, education, natural resources, what have you, and because of the structure of China's government, the ability to really get up to speed extremely quickly, how would they still need anything from the US? I was listening to a Tim Ferriss podcast. He was talking to somebody. I think they said something about machinists, just really, really high-end machinists was a good place to look if you wanted an example of why to answer that question. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think this actually goes back to the piece that you mentioned in your original question about, you know, closing the exit, right? This was something I wrote like a few, maybe 2 years ago. It was from the perspective of Chinese AI model startup founders at the time. At the time, they could still procure a reduced performance level of NVIDIA chips, as well as whatever Huawei was making at the time. And their biggest fear at the time, in terms of being reliant on chips, is actually you have this little opening that always lets you have some NVIDIA chips, but they're never the best NVIDIA chips, but you can't like not buy it because your own stuff is not good enough yet. So you kind of have this a debate in your head, if you will, all the time. And that is actually strategically at the time, probably the best situation for the United States. And as soon as they actually close the entire door, which is what we have now, then they have no other choice to just pour all of their money, which is their business, the revenue, to the domestic players, which is Huawei and a large ecosystem of other GPU makers and semiconductors makers at the time. And that will, just because of that flow of business alone, continue to accelerate Huawei's own progress, right? And if you come back to whether it's a Tim Ferriss thing or what have you, if you think the future is still about making stuff and then selling the best stuff to that you can make, there is definitely a moment in time, if we continue with this trajectory, where there's a lot less that China would need from the United States than vice versa, right? And the few things that I talked about, that list is becoming, shorter and shorter. Now, the value of those things are still very high. NVIDIA GPUs are still very sought after. They're still very advanced, bleeding edge. But at some point, maybe that gap will start to close as well. And you just settle for something that may not be the best in the world, but you can make it up with a lot of other advantages. One thing in AI infrastructure in particular that we're seeing now is that you do not need the best performing chip if you have a larger source of cheaper energy to fuel the less performant chips, and you can still build a lot of very impressive AI advancements. And the one thing that China is doing a lot better than the US, again, is producing nuclear power. It just green-lighted 10 more nuclear power plants this year. It has been doing a 10 power plant per year pace for the last 3 to 4 years. It actually has the best, safest nuclear power plant technology now, the fourth generation technology that it's going to roll out. And all this factor goes into some of the stuff that we're talking about, which is that, at some point, maybe China just does not need anything from the U.S. And we're certainly pushing them towards that direction as well. We don't want to give them anything that we have that they want, right? And the only way they could really continue is to make their own version of it. It could be better, it could be worse, but there's really only one path forward. And that is kind of where we are heading, which I guess to your point is a complete decoupling in a lot of ways.
And I love I'm a fan of nuclear power. Going to put it out there. And I can already sense the virtual legs coming my way now. Huge fan of nuclear power, to be honest. Let me ask you this. Point blank, who needs who more?
I think in the short term, we both need each other a lot. Let's be honest. We talk a lot about the technology side, which is what I focus on. But I think one of the things that this trade war so far has really illuminated for all of us is that the level of dependency between the US and China, meaning China makes a lot of the stuff that we here in the United States as everyday consumers use, have been taken completely for granted until a month ago. And these are things that are no longer we have here in the US because they're cheap, but because they're good, reliable, and cheap. These are strollers for your babies. These are your everyday like Home Depot equipment that you use to DIY your house. Maybe now because I live in the South and I do a lot of this stuff, I feel more closer to that experience, right? I told you before we started recording that I started playing hockey as one of my lifelong dreams. Well, guess what? I went to my local hockey shop 2 weeks ago to get my shin guards. And one, the shelf was half as empty as it used to be, and everything gone up 10 to 15%. And I was like, why? Because.
Or half as full.
It was right. Half is full, right? Didn't have my size. And everything, they marked up everything 10 to 15% over the previous 2 weeks entirely because of tariffs. Now, I think that shows a dependency, interdependency between the two sides. I just don't think there is a big enough hockey playing market in China to actually support the capacity of Bauer equipment production that is currently existing in Guangzhou right now. So if you take away the consumer power of the United States and Canada on that very niche product alone, the people who are making those in China, the workers, the factory owners, the business owners, they will suffer just as much as I do over here by having to pay a higher prices, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think there is a lot of I need you more than you need me more in reality. But from a posturing and a negotiation to your podcast's theme perspective, there will be a lot of, you know, staring down at each other as far as like, I need you, you actually need me more or vice versa. But in reality, we do need each other just as much as we always have and probably will in a lot of ways that we have already taken for granted.
You know, somewhat in the similar vein of that, there's a city about half an hour, 45 minutes to the south of me. It's probably around 185,000 people, but it is a super touristy hotbed, especially in the summer. Boats, lake, the whole thing, super hot. The population swells. Up here in British Columbia, Canada, they put a ban on short-term rentals, meaning Airbnb. Now, you could apply for exceptions. If you were a very tourist destination, you know, it was just like at a ski hill or something like that. Yeah. Okay. That could not be deemed worth living in full time for an extended period of time because it's really not functional. So it didn't make sense for them. But for most people, especially on the investor side, if you put all that time and work into making it cute and Instagram worthy and all that time under the platform to get your super host status and all these kind of things. So they did this and it really just threw everybody off. And then here's what happened. And the reason they did it was because there was a very short supply of places to rent. People were finding it very difficult to find a place to rent to live. And the government very myopically thought, oh, it's probably because of Airbnb. So let's hamstring Airbnb and it'll open up the supply. It did not. It did actually add some supply to what's for sale because investors in Airbnb are most interested in passive income and want nothing to do with being a landlord. That was not why they got into it. So instead of turning it into a long-term rental, they decided to put it up for sale and just get rid of it, move on and do other things with their money to make passive income elsewhere. But when that happened in Kelowna, the city south of me in particular, what the hotels did was jack their prices 50% because they had much less competition. And then tourism last summer was down 50% in that city, which hurt restaurant owners and cafes and nightclubs and just the guy at the beach who's renting out paddle boards. Everybody got smoked all summer long simply because of this one move that had a net negative effect across the board and didn't actually help the one thing that they said they were doing it to try to help. So I was drawn to just kind of talk about that story because of what you were talking about, the tug of war, back and forth, who gets hurt.
And, you know, like, I think, right, the larger picture is for most of the things that we do in our daily lives as citizens of, you know, countries that we live in and whatnot and pay taxes to, there's no national security implications to what we do, right? So the best way is to match the best supply with the most demand and let economics 101 do its thing. Now, I think part of what this whole U.S.-China rivalry is trying to solve for, at least on the U.S. side, is the United States does need to at least onshore enough capacity of making certain things that are very critical to national security that should not be outsourced to, frankly, any country, let alone a country that does have, you know, different point of view about how the world should be. China certainly has never really wanted to have American technology running its infrastructure if it could help it. That's part of the early stories of Huawei becoming the juggernaut that it is. It's because the country at the time was too backwards and they have to use Cisco routers and, you know, IBM mainframes and whatnot. But there was always this conscientious effort that at least for certain parts of the country, we just cannot use foreign technology. And the United States somehow has like really never really took that lesson seriously until now. But the problem now with what we do is that we completely blow up the definition of national security to include everything from cars to toys to garlic to just like all the silly stuff, when really we should just onshore certain elements of the military supply chain or communication supply chain and have that be the equilibrium going forward. And hopefully that's what we'll see. We certainly are not quite there yet.
Okay, maybe I live in my little Canadian padded room echo chamber life of zero threats when I say this, but I can't help but smirk when somebody says national security, because I think they're always talking militarily. And let's be honest, it is national security financially, data protection and what, like, I don't think there's a military threat. I think it's just a financial threat. Am I wrong?
I think what you are reacting to is what I described just now, which is the overuse, that you say, of national security as the excuse to do whatever it is that you are going to do that has nothing to do with actual national security. Sort of this watering down of the meaning right off the term. And it's always been a very convenient term in the history of U.S. politics and U.S. policy to achieve certain ends that is much more aggressive than it probably needs to be, but it either benefits certain players or it plays a certain ideology. And national security has always been a very powerful way to justify those ends, right? I think the latest version of it in the United States is what is called economic security, right? Workforces, people getting displaced, and that is a justification for high tariffs to onshore certain manufacturing back to the United States in ways that, if again, we talk about robots, we talk about robotic arms and automation, that stuff is never going to really come back in a sustainable way anyways, even in China. And that's sort of a Chinese social problem that I am waiting to see how they deal with that. When the massive automation going through all of their factories that is very much green lighted and supported by the government will cause massive employment displacement. And what does that do for the social fabric of, third tier, fourth tier Chinese cities, right? And that's something that's actually like a little bit ahead of the social element of stuff that we haven't even talked about. How do you make social policies and healthcare policies and social safety net policies around that world? I think China actually has to deal with that first. And the United States, given our lack of automation pace, will maybe wait and see to see what they're doing and maybe learn some good lessons from that. But that is where we are now. And the overuse of national security as a term is I think problematic and unfortunate, and I think in a lot of ways.
Potentially just to keep the populace, I think, supportive due to a national threat. Lean in on that national pride. Let's get that flag out. And it just kind of helped people keep them a little bit more distracted. I think the pretense of a potential military threat will continue to keep support where it needs to be. Okay, bonus round, 60 seconds each. First one up, what should investors and tech watchers pay attention to in China's tech sector? Any underrated trends, potential surprises in the next year regarding Chinese AI, cloud, or hardware? Go.
I think one company that people should pay more attention to is Xiaomi. And also the Xiaomi ecosystem. So Xiaomi used to be this low-end smartphone maker, and is now one really leveling up to become a premium brand smartphone provider. It is also making its own electric vehicles that all happened within the last 3-4 years, really, that is now really giving Tesla a run for its money. And very recently, it started to release its own chip, its own flagship smartphone chip, kind of like the A14 in your iPhone. They are starting to really show results on that front that was 10 years in the making, but they're finally getting to be able to ship some products in their own indigenous chip making. And it has an ecosystem of, Kingsoft Cloud is a small cloud provider in China that is tied into the Xiaomi ecosystem because they're founded by the same founder. founder, you know. So Kingsoft Cloud is actually fueling a lot of the Xiaomi AI model making. Xiaomi just released its own open source AI model actually in the last month or so. So they're now getting into the AI model game. I think they poached quite a few folks actually from DeepSeek to be able to build that team. So that is one company slash ecosystem that I think is really underrated, under research, and is doing some really fascinating things. And their global footprint is quite significant as well in Africa, Latin America, in terms of their phones. I think they're one of the most popular EV brands in the Middle East, is what I've heard.
Are they listed anywhere?
They're listed on Hong Kong.
Okay.
They're a publicly traded company in Hong Kong, and Kingsoft Cloud and Kingsoft, the software company, this is like the Windows equivalent. It's like Office, you know, software stuff, right? That those two entities are both all listed in Hong Kong. Kingsoft Cloud also has an ADR listing in the United States.
Any final thoughts? Anything quick that you want to just pass along? And then after you just kind of speak your piece, where do people come and follow you and get signed up and subscribe to that interconnected newsletter?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that everyone can do now, especially with AI's language translation capability getting better and better, is there's lower and lower barrier to consume information that is just openly on the internet that is not your home or your native tongue, essentially, right? Like, I'm a global investor. I don't just focus on China. China is certainly a place that has a lot of technology. So if you invest in technology, you don't pay attention to China, you're kind of not doing your job, right? But even if you don't do this on a daily basis or for a living, there's a lot of information that's just hidden in plain sight. And I think there's more of an attention deficit than a information deficit when it comes to just understanding all the stuff about China in particular that we just talked about. So I hope people do that. You can certainly learn it via my newsletter, but that's just one person's take on a lot of these things. So you can go to Substack and search for Interconnected with an ED. I guess I'm doing it in the past tense to find my newsletter on Substack. And we will, you know, happy to have people engage with me online to keep the conversation going, because a lot of these things are moving pieces.
Kevin Hsu, founder of Interconnected. Thank you very much, buddy, for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so for everybody who is listening, don't forget to go watch on the WPIC YouTube channel. We'd love it if you could give us a rate, if you could subscribe, anything like that, a nice review. Just helps the algorithm monsters help us get put in front of more people to check us out. If you want to give us any feedback, podcast@wpic.co. We'd love any guest recommendations or advice that you might have. But from me, from everybody at The Negotiation, and for Kevin, thank you for listening and or watching, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.